This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This past legislative session was both active and at times controversial. After a century out of power, Republicans took over the General Assembly and the governor's office and wasted no time in making up for lost time. That set off a series of Moral Monday demonstrations at the State House, which have now come to Charlotte. Later in the program, we meet one of the leaders of the Moral Monday protest, actually two of them, to talk about why they felt compelled to demonstrate, what they believe they accomplished, and what they hope to accomplish by bringing those protests here. But first, we're going to explore one of the pieces of legislation that Moral Monday protesters found very unappetizing, the voter ID law. It was signed into law last week by Governor McCrory after receiving a considerable amount of national attention. Republican proponents say the changes brought about by the law are necessary to curb voter fraud. Opponents allege that voter fraud is virtually non-existent and characterize the measure as a thinly veiled excuse to disenfranchise voters. Joining us to talk about all of this is State Senator Bob Ruscio from Mecklenburg County, the chief author of that bill. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Mike.
Welcome to the program. Jim Morrill is a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer who spent much time in Raleigh this session covering the legislature. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And because of the changes in this legislation affect not only voters, but those who run elections, we've invited Michael Dickerson to be here. He is director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. Thanks for joining us, Michael. Welcome
back. Great to be here.
And as soon as she arrives, Martha Kropp will be here, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. She researches voter turnout and election patterns. Senator, tell us again why Republicans in North Carolina and around the country feel the need to pass these voter ID laws.
Well, Mike, there are 30 other states that have voter ID laws. We're the last one in the Southeast that has made an effort to implement this. You know, it's a matter of saying, and I think a recent Elon University poll came out, and nearly three-quarters of the people in North Carolina think that it's not unfair, it's not unreasonable, since it's required in life and in society to have a photo identification for voting. You need it to go into an airplane. You need it to cash a check. You need it for everything else. And in reality, there are a lot of folks who believe that with it, we raise the level of integrity, honesty within the electoral process. And that being said, we will also increase the level of confidence in government.
Does it surprise you how vehemently opposed to this some people are?
Well, you know, it's a matter of change. Whenever change occurs, unfortunately, you know, there are 33 other states, as I alluded to. There are some of them that are still in the process of getting approval that have already instituted it. You know, my feeling and the feeling of the legislature was this was appropriate. The people of North Carolina expected it. And therefore, you know, we're hearing a minority of people complain about a change that, you know, in reality is just normal way of doing business.
Michael, long before this issue ever came up, it kind of puzzled me once. I don't know why. It was a long line. I was standing in line at the voting place, and I just had a lot of time to think. And I thought, you know, I just came in here, and they asked me my name. They asked me my address. They didn't ask to see any proof of any of that, and I'm standing in line getting ready to vote. Now, I could have said that I was Joe Blow from Eastway Drive and gone to that precinct and voted and come to my own precinct and given my own name and my own address and voted here. Why isn't there, because I'm told there's not a lot of voter fraud by some people, why isn't there more voter fraud?
Well, the fear of being thrown in jail and all of
How would you throw me in jail if you don't know who I am when I'm giving you a false name?
If it was discovered, that's what I'm saying. The whole bit of if somebody discovers that you have done this, you violated the law, the general statutes. So that to me is it. Keep in mind what we've always done at the Board of Elections is we've always verified your ID before you got there. So you would give us your name and your address, and give us the last four digits of your Social Security number, driver's license number, and through that we run it through a system of DMV checks.
Yeah, hold on. When did you ask me those questions?
On your voter registration application.
Okay,
when
all
you
right.
first got that. So before you got there, we knew you were a person. You weren't some thing made up. So you weren't going to be able to just make up fake names and go somewhere else to vote. So we've verified all that under the current law, and that's the process that we had to use.
If there were a lot of voter fraud, would you, as the director of the Board of Elections, be aware of it?
I think you're going to find anything that's going to affect a change, yes, you're going to find a lot of we would be able to be aware of it. People aren't going to be that quiet about.
So how much voter fraud do you think there is? And from your experience, do you know there is?
No, I really have not seen anything here in Mecklenburg County that would claim that we'd have a problem.
Jim Morrill, are you aware of what the situation is around the state?
Well, I think that some people have alleged voter fraud elsewhere, but not many cases of it, to tell you the truth. I mean, there have been a relative handful of allegations of voter fraud in the state.
So I come back to the original question. Why? Because I hear this all over the country from people who are either opposed to voter ID or people who just look at it and go, this is an unnecessary law because there is no fraud to speak of. Why do you feel it's so important?
Mike, Michael Dickerson made a point. You know, they ask for the IDs up front, and then when you go there, and if I go to the election and I say, well, you know, I am John Smith, and I live at this address, and that's all they ask of you. You know, there are ways of looking online today and evaluating the people that haven't voted for 10 and 12 years and likely will not be there. I could easily be that person. The other part is the reason why you don't identify voter fraud, especially in that manner, is like speeding on the highway. If you didn't have police officers out there with radar, with other ways of evaluating speeding, you wouldn't recognize speeding. The same way today, there is no one out there, there is no system out there that presently evaluates voter fraud. When we were at a redistricting meeting in Durham, a fellow came up, and out of the clear blue, we were talking about redistricting. He said, I was at three different locations in Durham. I could have easily voted, but I chose not to. Mm-hmm. So in reality, there's nothing that prevents people from doing it, and it sure isn't the fear of the penalty, because guess what? The penalty is insignificant.
Martha?
Oh, and I'm sorry I'm late.
It's okay.
The travails of being a working mother, I suppose. Hello, Senator.
I see you.
So here's what I have to say about the voter fraud. So I've been reading a lot about this. I've reviewed books about this. Think about the costs and the benefits of the kind of systematic fraud that you would need to have to change an election. The costs are and anybody's going to make a rational decision about this. The cost of committing the kind of fraud it would take to change an election, even Florida in 2000 was 500 votes. That's a lot of people. The costs are so high that it totally outweighs the benefits, number one. So number two, you would have to do some pretty systematic evaluation of the voters, which you're right. Since we're a fairly transparent state, certainly a lot of public records are very public for voting, and that's absolutely, you're absolutely right about that. But the kind of evaluation that you would have to do to be able to commit the fraud, it takes a lot of time, effort. There's so many moving parts that someone's going to find out about it. So my third point is also that there is a social norm for speeding. People speed. Nobody complains. Even I do it. And I'm kind of a Miss Get All A sort of, you know, that kind of, you went to, everybody went to school with that kind of person, right? So I'll make fun of myself. I'll be a little deprecating. I feel terrible that I'm late, right? There's a social norm against this idea of the fraud on a systematic basis. The guy went, he could have voted, he didn't. Why not? Because there's a social norm against it. We have almost a religious feeling about voting in this country. Really, we do. I mean, if you think about how we take voting, how seriously most people take voting, you take it very seriously. I think that the chances of fraud, sure, they're there. Sure, speeding is there, but everybody speeds.
So
why shouldn't I speed?
What I'm hearing you, I'm hearing you as a kind of an advocate against these voter ID laws.
Oh, no. What I think, okay, so as an academic, I'm a professor. I get the idea of the voter ID laws, right? I've even said myself in D.C., I could have been Sox the cat and voted, Right? That's how I felt. This was, of course, when Sox the cat was President Clinton's cat, and I lived there. But I think about where we are as a state right now. We have limited budgets. We are having fiscal austerity, economic problems. I think if we sat down and weighed the probability of fraud being this kind of problem against the benefits that this could provide, people have high confidence in elections, I think that public policy-wise, this isn't a good necessarily a good decision.
Senator Zirk.
And just use an example, okay. And I'm probably old enough to remember the Kennedy and Nixon election.
Yeah.
It turned out to be one vote in every single precinct in America. So to say that you can't change one vote, 10 votes per precinct, is probably not a fair statement. But in reality, unless you have some assurances, and we've made it a very simple way of making sure that everyone that comes to the poll, you can identify in a very simple manner. We've opened up the opportunity for a free non-operating license with the Department of Motor Vehicle, a free one.
Sorry. Who's going to pay for it?
A free one. Well,
who's gonna
the reality
for
is we'll accept the responsibility for that. And we will.
Who's we?
The
who's
General
we?
Assembly will.
Okay, so you're going to open up your own personal wallet and pay for this?
General,
I've read that law up and down, right and left. I couldn't tell anyone who's going to pay for it except for the DMV. Apparently, Mr. Dickerson here,
it will
his
be done
office,
with budgets if you pay close attention
okay,
to
okay.
the law.
Oh, yeah, I have been paying. So who under what part of the law?
It will be budgeted to the department. I mean, under the either DMV or the Board of Elections, one or the other.
Okay,
we'll
the law doesn't say that. It pretty much says it's the I mean, as far as I can tell, and maybe Mr. Morrill's. I know you've read it up and down and right and left, and I'm pretty sure that Mr. Dickerson here has read it up and down and right and left and backwards and forward too.
Yep.
And it's not clear the way that the House bill.
All
is,
right, Michael, you're the Board of Elections. Who's paying for the IDs? If you don't have a driver's license, who's paying for the IDs that you have to get to vote?
First off, let me, before it gets too much deeper, this is a phased-in process.
It is.
We have a 2013 primary.
Mm-hmm.
I've got early voting starting this Thursday. So everything we're talking about today is something that will start after 2014.
2016?
ID is 2016. But everything else. So please, as you come out to vote this Thursday at the Hal Marshall Annex at 8 o'clock in the morning.
You don't need to bring ID.
No, you don't need to bring an ID. And you want to make sure that that folks are aware of this. I don't want to get 1,000 phone calls today saying, well, what kind of ID do I need for this Thursday?
But by 2016, when these IDs are required by the law, who pays for the non-driver's license ID?
Well, the driver's license, the non-driver's license ID, all of that is going through the DMV according to this part of the law. Somebody at the DMV would have to be paying for
that. So I take it, Martha, that your point is, and I only have 40 seconds left in this segment, that your point is that in a budget environment of austerity or cutbacks, that this is going to add additional costs because the people who don't have driver's license and who don't pay to get driver's licenses will now get free identification cards.
Yeah,
how much could that cost?
Well,
what is it, 600,000 people we're talking about?
Oh, no, well, actually, they've redone the matching.
Okay.
And they've used some different matching protocols. It's looking like it's somewhere around 300,000.
$300,000 or less.
People
the numbers,
need the IDs.
The numbers in Georgia were up to 600 and less, and it turned out to be less than 60,000. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. And what we believe is that it will be able to be solved, and we're budgeting for 15, 16, not now, in the future.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of this conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants, caring for patient safety, needs, and comfort. Information on facilities SAC serves is available at seanesthesiology.com. Listen up, parents-to-be. Bloomberg News reports a middle-income family will spend $241,080 to raise a child born in 2012. That's a 2.6% increase from last year, and it outstrips the rate of inflation. But that's just one. Money is just one consideration when planning to start or expand a family, and we'll talk about a bunch of them tomorrow morning at 9. You can join today's conversation by going to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks and make a comment on our webpage or interact with us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can do it right now.
on the next Diane Rehm Show. As the White House nears a decision on the Keystone Pipeline, communities in Arkansas and Michigan are still cleaning up from major oil spills. Debate over shipping oil through pipelines.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the new voter ID law with one of the bill's principal sponsors, Senator Bob Rucho, Republican from Mecklenburg County. Jim Morrill is a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Michael Dickerson is director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. And Martha Kropf is associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. Governor McCrory felt it necessary and important to make a public statement when signing the voter ID law. Let's hear what he had to say.
Hi, I'm Governor Pat McCrory. The integrity of our election process is vital to our democracy, which is why I've signed today several common sense reforms into law, including voter ID. Photo ID has become a part of our everyday life. You need a photo ID to board an airplane, to cash a check, or even apply for most government benefits. In fact, just recently, both Democrats and Republicans joined together to require a valid government-issued photo ID to buy Sudafed at your local corner drugstore. Our right to vote deserves similar protection. In fact, for voters who may not even have a photo ID, they can get one at no charge at a nearby DMV office throughout the state. To ensure everyone has enough time, photo ID won't be required until the 2016 elections. Let me be direct. Many of those from the extreme left who have been criticizing photo ID are using scare tactics. They're more interested in divisive politics than ensuring that no one's vote is disenfranchised by a fraudulent ballot. Protecting the integrity of every vote cast is among the most important duties I have as governor. And it's why I sign these common sense, commonplace protections into law. Thank you very much.
Now, the governor mentioned that criticisms were nothing more than scare tactics by the left. One of those criticisms, Senator, is that this law will make it harder for the elderly, the poor, minorities, and students to vote. Many older Americans no longer have driver's licenses. Many poor and minority individuals don't have driver's licenses. What forms of ID will be acceptable for them to use to get the ID cards that they require for to vote?
Well, it's just as if you were going to get a license, your place of birth, your residence, just getting IDs or getting a registered to vote, the same ID is going to be approved. It's a simple process. It's not complicated. And most of the time, there are IDs that are already out there. I just sent a kid up to Chapel Hill, and every single one of those young people have already photo IDs.
Can I walk in with my Social Security card and get a voter ID card when this goes into effect?
In the process, Michael, is that the same as for registration? Is that an acceptable?
Well, I take your last four digits of your Social Security card currently.
But how do I prove, Michael, when I register to vote? I'm a new citizen. I just moved here Tennessee. How do I prove who I am to you?
You give me a name and address and a Social Security number, last four digits of it, a driver's license number. And at that point in time, we cross-check your name and address with the Department of Motor Vehicles to make sure you are a person.
And that's how it will work to get the voter ID card for any individual who walks in to get one?
Well, this is I can't speak for the DMV on this.
It'll be the same standard. I mean, they're registering to vote, basically, by getting that non-operating license.
Wait a second, but don't you have to have a birth certificate? And if you've just been married, a marriage certificate? I mean, there are higher standards to get a driver's license, actually.
There are now because of 9/11.
Because of 9/11. And so there's the – okay, so where would you get – if you needed your birth certificate, where would you go?
To my house.
Where's your house?
In Matthews.
Okay. So you keep a copy of your birth certificate.
Along with every one of members of my family.
But what if you don't?
Well, then you go to this.
Because the reason I have a birth certificate is because I had to get a passport because I had to leave the country. Most people don't leave the country, so they don't need a passport. Therefore, they may not know where their birth certificate is or how to get one. How do you get your birth? I don't know how you get your birth certificate.
What I did in the past when I needed one, I called back to Worcester, Massachusetts, and identified myself and got a certified copy
how
of my birth certificate.
How did they know who you were?
Okay. So wait. So you went to. You called to Worcester, Massachusetts. How much did it cost to get your birth certificate from Worcester?
Oh, who remembers? That was 30, 40 years ago.
Oh, probably so, like $5.
If that much.
Well, that's part of the issue here is that this is going to cost people who can't afford it money. And if you don't have the money, you can't vote.
Well,
is that fair?
I just brought my other son in to get his license
the other day.
And
you're well-to-do.
It required
but
a birth certificate.
And you're educated, too.
So you're well-to-do, and you're educated, and you make a decent amount of money. You're a dentist. What about people
retired?
Okay, but what about people who don't make money? What about people who struggle to scrape together enough money just to subsist every week?
The license process is simple, Mike. It is there and available for anybody that wants to use it.
Well, hold it, Martha. What about those who don't have a car? What about those who would find it onerous to go and get their birth certificate, to go and register to vote, to go and get a driver, go to the DMV because they don't have a car.
There is already a non-operational ID card that is available with the Division of Motor Vehicles. If the same standard is held by Michael Dickerson at the Board of Elections, that will likely be the same standard held by the Department of Motor Vehicles in issuing that license.
And I got to tell you, you say the words DMV. And a nightmare pops into my head. They can barely handle the people trying to get their learner's permits, much less renewals of licenses, and now this.
Between now and 2016, when it is required, there'll be plenty of opportunity to achieve that. And as I alluded to earlier, the scare tactics came out in...
Okay, wait.
Excuse
me. Let's not talk about scare tactics.
The scare tactics came out...
Let's talk about it reasonably.
The scare tactics came out... When Georgia initially talked about a voter ID, a voter photo ID, and they talked about 600,000 people needed IDs, it turned out to be less than 60,000. So in reality, there's almost a year and a half to 2 years of getting information and being able to get everyone that needs an ID, an ID.
Jim Morrill.
Mike, I was just going to say that this bill goes way beyond the issue of photo ID.
Yes.
There's a lot of other things it does, if you want to talk about some of those.
I would. Let me
just say birth certificates. If you live in North Carolina, one thing they did that was good is they say that you can get those documents for free if you certify that you don't have another license.
Jim, I'm going to go back to
you. But not if you live in Worcester, Mass.
Let me do the show, okay? Please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Jim Morrill.
Like I said, this bill goes way beyond just the voter ID. It shortens the early voting period, although it keeps the same number of hours, but in a more condensed period. It ends same-day registration. It ends the whole practice of straight ticket voting, ends pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. So I think its effects are going to be felt far beyond just the ID at the polls.
Why end early voting? Why cut it short by 7 days?
Well, in 1997, when I went there, your previous person that was in the Board of Elections, I used the information, and actually one of my first bills was a early voting or what was called a non-excuse voting, which prior to that, you needed to have a medical excuse or something of that sort to get the chance to vote. Well, this actually streamlined it. And in reality, the way the law is written, the way it was amended with a bipartisan effort, we actually have the same amount of hours as a minimal level. It can be increased. But what it does do is it goes from 17 days to 10 days prior to the election. And in that same 10 days, you have, if you had 2,000 hours in 2008, you would have 2,000 hours in that same period. So you have more opportunities to vote. You also have the ability to increase the number of locations. What that means is if Mr. Dickerson says, well, we have the money budgeted, we can add two or three or five locations. You're adding more voting machines in place. You'll reduce the lines. Even as many as we have, many times when I was out there, when I took my mother there, we waited 2 hours to vote. We're trying to find a way to, one, improve the process, make it easier on Board of Election Administration, and more importantly, there are 100 counties in the state of North Carolina. We're trying to uniform and make it all conform to the same rules so that there's no misunderstanding as to how to operate the election
Michael
process.
Dickerson, you told WFAE's Michael Tomczyk that early voting is hugely popular. Voters actually enjoy it. Do you see this as diminishing the amount of time that voters have to vote or simply shifting the hours? Around.
Well, as I look at it, it's shifting the hours. The General Assembly has told me this is how we have to do it. This is what we'll do. We had exactly 2,700 hours in that neighborhood in 2012 for early voting. So now I'll add a couple more sites. I'll have to extend the hours from 11 to 7, maybe 8 to 9. Little things that we'll have to do as to figure out how to work.
Martha Kropf, you study voter turnout. How many vote early versus on election day? And does early voting favor one party over another?
Well, okay. It does, in the case of mobilization, favor one party over another. When
favor the Democrats over the Republicans?
Right. Now, because of the very active mobilization efforts on the part of the Democratic Party,
mm-hmm.
Definitely it has favored the Democrats. African Americans have been more likely to vote early during this time. In the past, conventional wisdom has had it that it's actually, I guess in the past prior to, say, 2004, actually, it's Republicans that have been more likely to vote early and mostly absentee. So it's not necessarily something that benefits one party or the other. But the most convincing research that I've seen about early voting says that one party or another, and this might even be a quote from one of your articles because you've read the research too, indicates that when a political party is able to mobilize and take advantage of the reform, then it helps.
This law also cuts preteen voting registration. I mean, you have to be – you can't – if you're not 18 years of age today, you can't register to vote now for an election for which you will be 18 and legally able to vote. Why – it's almost as though politicians – and I'm lumping you all together here, Democrats and Republicans – really don't want us to vote.
That's far from the truth.
Why eliminate opportunities to register to vote?
It doesn't eliminate. All it does is allows – you know, just like when my son turned
– But if I'm 17 years old right now and on election day I will be 18, why not allow me to register to vote now?
Well, I'll tell you. One example is that when my son went to school – and actually pre-registered to vote, and I received a letter prior to this last election saying, well, are you going to vote? Well, he didn't turn 18 until January 31st, so he really wasn't eligible. There was a lot of confusion. I actually called the folks at the Board of Elections in Raleigh and said, well, what is this all about? Why are we sending out letters that of people that aren't supposed to vote? The fact is, when you turn 18, if you're a young man, you're going to register for the draft, you're going to – which he did. You're going to register to vote, which he did. So the bottom line is all it does is there is uniformity into the system.
But if I am 17 and on election day I will be 18 and perhaps my birthday is election day or the day before election day or the Sunday before election day, you have also eliminated same day registration. So I can't come and register to vote the day I vote. Why not?
On the same day registration, yeah. The issue of that is very simply, it is confusing. When you try to work with the Board of Elections, you're trying to give them an opportunity to validate when someone comes to register to vote. You have the opportunity, the Board of Elections folks, to say, well, this is going to take us some time to go through the process that he's talking about and to be able to say, yes, this isn't true. Someone that lives in North Carolina, that lives in precinct 129 or whatever it is, it allows them to validate that registration.
Again, this law does not go into effect for the coming election, so that's not the case right now. But if I come to you on election day to register to vote, how big a problem is it for you, Michael? And do you hold that vote out until you've confirmed the person's identification?
Well, first off, nobody in North Carolina registers to vote on election day itself, the actual election day. This is during the early voting process.
Okay.
And what we do at that point is we're required here in Mecklenburg County in North Carolina to enter that information within 2 business days. Now, we're very fortunate in this county. We live in a great county, and the county has always funded us so that I can do that. I can actually do all the data entry here in my county and get that card out within 2 business days. Now, if I am going to be 18 before the election, but prior to cutoff, the General Assembly hasn't changed that at all. That is going to stay the process. So if I'm going to – I can still register pre – at that point. Say I'm going to be 18. This is what we – what we're talking about, what we were talking about earlier, was the 16 and 17-year-olds who are able to pre-register to vote. If I'm going to be 18 by election day, I can register. There's a window of time that I can register between, I think it's April and October. So I can register and still vote on election day. So that's not going to change there. So don't worry about that for all you 18-year-olds.
The law also eliminates straight party ticket voting. Martha, how many people avail themselves of going in there and pulling one lever for everything?
You know, I don't know the exact numbers.
It's 1.4 million last fall.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
1.4 million people went in and pulled.
Yeah.
And, of course, in North Carolina, if you don't vote, you have to vote for president separately, and then you pull the lever for Democrat or Republican to vote straight party ticket. Why eliminate that?
Well, part of it is a confusing issue. You can talk with Michael about it, but the fact is a lot of folks thought they could vote for president and they shoot the whole ticket. It's not true. It doesn't work that way.
Why not change that and let them vote for president and vote?
Well, you know, that was the way it used to be, but the Democrats changed it, I think, when Reagan won North Carolina, and they changed that law. But the rest of the issue regarding the straight tickets is – you know, when you choose Republican or Democrat, you miss a number of down-ballot elections that should have some, importance to the system, whether they're judges or whether they're conservation and soil or whatever. But the fact is the voter never gets a chance to vote because they're voting that way. They think that one way or another is there. What it does is it allows the voter or gives them some responsibility to be informed and to be able to vote for every single race on the ticket. We believe that's important.
I have a minute left, and one of the serious criticisms about this law and about other laws like it around the country has to do with bringing back Jim Crow, that this is disenfranchising the poor, it's disenfranchising minorities, it disenfranchises young people, college students, and people like that. And it's a deliberate attempt, some say, by the Republicans to tamp down on those who would be most likely to vote for Democrats. What's your response?
I think – well, first of all, I don't agree with your premise.
Okay.
And the reality is that what it does is it treats everybody the same. It is a uniform. It is going to allow conformity of the entire electoral process. It will allow people like Michael Dickerson and all other 99 boards of elections to run a very efficient operation, and therefore everyone will have a chance to vote. The rhetoric that you talked about is simply false.
I wish we had time to talk about the airport, Senator, but that'll be another day. Senator Bob Rucho, Republican from Mecklenburg County, principal sponsor of the voter ID law. Also, Jim Morrill from The Observer, Martha Kropp from UNC Charlotte, Michael Dickerson, director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. Thank you all. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Catawba College in Salisbury, serving traditional and adult students since 1851, an education dedicated to personal attention, blending liberal arts with career preparation. Details at catawba.edu. As the White House nears a decision on the Keystone XL pipeline, communities in Arkansas and Michigan are still dealing with major oil spills. Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the safety of shipping oil through pipelines coming up at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show. By the way, if you want to hear more discussion about the recent legislative session in Raleigh, you can. We're working with the Charlotte Observer and PBS Charlotte on a forum on August 28th with 7 state legislators, including, I believe, Senator Bob Rucho, to talk about the issues important to all of us. You can find information about that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming back to talk about Moral Mondays in just a moment.
News happens at any time with a speed that can take your breath away. Public radio reporters are getting the story straight right here in the next state over and around the world. It's a network that keeps you connected. It's a network that never shuts down. Check in for an update on your world.
NPR News, plus local and regional news all day on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The voter ID law was but one measure that sparked controversy and protests during this last legislative session. Every Monday for 11 weeks, protesters converged on Raleigh to make their displeasure known. And now that the legislature has adjourned, the protests are continuing and have been brought to Charlotte today at 5 p.m. Marshall Park. There will be a Moral Monday protest, come rain or shine. The Reverend Dr. William Barber, president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, is the leader of the Moral Monday rallies. He joins us now by phone from Manteo. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike, and good morning to all of your listeners.
Good morning. And in our Spirit Square studio is Reverend Kojo Nantambu, president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg chapter of the NAACP. Thank you for being here as well.
Good morning, Mike. Peace and blessings to you. And you made a mistake. It was for 13 weeks.
Okay, 13 weeks. I thought I was wrong about that number, but thank you for correcting me. Let's start with the issue we just spent 40 minutes talking about, and that is the voter ID law. Reverend Barber, you have called the legislation extreme and immoral. How so?
Well, also, it's the most vulgar attempt to engage in political manipulation by changing our laws and attacking our most fundamental laws. Right, our fundamental law in this democracy, which is the right to vote. First of all, it's not a voter ID law. That's the first misnomer. That's the attempt by the extremists in our legislature to frame it as such. That would be bad enough because we already have the best law. It's called signature attestation. Sign your name. If you lie, you get a 5-year felony. We've not needed anything else for 237 years in this state. There's no evidence of voter fraud. 18 million votes studied. We found no evidence of fraud. So that is first of all a red herring, and it's not a voter ID law. It's a voter suppression law, because not only did they put in place the most restrictive voter ID in the nation, more restrictive than Alabama and South Carolina, they also are ending same day registration and early voting, which is used heavily by minorities and others. They're scaling back early voting, which is used heavily by minorities and others. They are changing it so that if you vote out of precinct, they won't be counted, as opposed to the past. You would get a provisional ballot, and those ballots would be counted. They are attacking college students. They're disallowing 17-year-olds from pre-registering. This is bad, bad legislation. And on top of that, the voter ID, 300,000 North Carolinians do not have the current type of voter ID that they're requiring, and 67% of them are women, and 34% of them are African American, even though we make up only about 20% of the electorate. This is nothing more than voter suppression. They know it, we know it, and that's why we're suing. And that's why we're going to win in court.
I want to move to other issues, but Reverend Ntambo, make us understand why it is that if Reverend Barber is right, that minorities and young people and some elderly people make more use of same-day voter registration and early voting than others, why is that so?
Well, basically it has to do with the transportation and convenience situation. A lot of times those people don't have anyone to pick them up, or they don't have opportunity to go because either they're riding the bus or they don't have money to get in the bus. So if you have early voting, that gives you more time to arrange for a situation where you can get to the polls and get back home. But if you just have, let's say, one day as we used to have, or if you have a shorter period of time, you may not be able to arrange that with a neighbor, a friend, a family member to take you there and then bring you back. So it proposes a serious obstacle for young people and the elderly and those who may be handicapped, because it takes time to get somebody to step up for them to help them get to the polls.
NPR reported last Friday on the impact this voter law may have on rural counties. Mecklenburg County at least has some transit available to people who don't own automobiles. It's not always easy to use, but it's getting better. They spent some time in Bertie County, NPR did, down east. And Reverend Vonner Horton told NPR many of these people don't have cars. They can't afford automobiles. For years, Horton and her church, the state's state's early voting, used the state's early voting system to make sure as many people as possible could vote. They send vans across the county door to door to pick up people and take them to the polls, but they're always short on time. She says, do the math. One church van holds about 10 people. Gathering them up can take more than an hour. Then you have to drive to different polling places, long distances apart. Repeat all of this a few more times in one day, and you've only got about 50 ballots in the box. Right. And this new law has now cut the early voting from 17 down to 10 days. You're calling us from Manteo, Reverend. I would think that situation is very applicable there.
Yeah, I'm right. I'm calling for Manny. I hope the signal holds. That's another issue. The signal here.
I think we've lost his cell phone. I'm sorry to say. So I'm going to leave you up there, Reverend, but I'll get the comment from Reverend Nantambu. In rural counties,
oh, yes.
It is a burden.
It's a very serious burden. It's a burden here. And if you watch the Charlotte Transit, you understand and know without a doubt that most of the riders on Charlotte Transit, there is a large and inordinate amount of minorities and others that ride the transit, which means they obviously don't have regular transportation, or they don't have license to drive. And then when you put that to the people that you don't see who don't have transportation or may not have adequate transportation by getting the invalid or the elderly back and forth, because black folks, because of our situation, you have a lot of people that work all day, work two or three jobs, so they can't go pick up Mama. They can't go pick up Aunt Helen. And so somebody else has to come to get them, and that's where the churches and other organizations get in, and it takes time to get those people to the poll.
Let's take the conspiracy theories out of this, and let's take the name-calling out of this, and let's say, let's give the people who passed all these pieces of legislation that Moral Mondays have been protesting, is not about evil. It's not about suppression. It's not about hurting somebody and to the benefit of someone else. It's a lack of – let's just say it's a lack of misunderstanding. Did you have any opportunity to speak directly to legislators passing that voter ID bill or any of the other legislation?
Go ahead, Dr. Barnes.
Dr. Barber? I think we have a serious problem.
They won't
with
allow.
Cell
they
phone.
Didn't allow. Dr. Barber and a lot of our coalition members have tried several times, and the reason we were arrested because just 2 years ago we went to talk to the General Assembly about voter ID when Bev was there, and we were put out. The Speaker of the House would not let us speak. And so they're not allowing us to speak to them, even though the Constitution of the State of North Carolina says that we have the right. It is our responsibility to instruct our representatives in the General Assembly as to what we want, but they will not listen to us. They will not allow us a reasonable opportunity to speak to them on the facts about voting and about voter ID.
Where did the idea, Dr. Barber, and I hope I can talk to you, you were having some cell phone problems, but where did the idea for these Moral Monday protests come from? I think we certainly have, we'll try to reestablish the connection.
Well, it came from the fact that Dr. Barber himself is one of the people that spawned this idea, and what it was is that we didn't know what else that we could do. We had tried appealing to the General Assembly. We'd been up there. We'd talked to them many times.
But you just told me that they wouldn't talk to you.
I say we tried to talk. We appealed to them. Okay. We tried to talk to them. And we had been up there many times before sitting in the General Assembly and actually protesting in the General Assembly. And then after this, we realized there was really nothing we could do. So we decided that one of the things that we could do is at least go to the General Assembly, make our presence known, pray, and appeal in that way by praying and saying what was wrong with what was going on there by espousing those things that were very relevant to what was happening and how they could be changed. And so Dr. Barber came up with the idea of why don't we just try civil disobedience, and that civil disobedience was to be implemented by just being in the General Assembly praying mm-hmm. and just spending time until we got arrested. And what happened, it just exploded. After about 2 or 3 weeks, it took off, and people all over the country decided to get involved.
During those 13 weeks, thank you for correcting me, during those 13 weeks of Moral Monday protests in Raleigh, how many people overall do you think participated? Do you have any clear idea?
I have no doubt that it was at least 50,000 to 60,000
people. Was it the same people every week, or did more people?
No. And that's the thing. There were a lot of people that came back, but a lot of times it was new people every week, because each week, new people found out. The information became so prominent that other people decided, well, I want to come. You know, I want to be involved. And that's what made it expand. We had a lot of new people every week, and then we had a lot of the same. So each week it got more and more because new people came every week.
Some have compared the Moral Monday movement to a smaller version of the Tea Party movement. Are you the opposite side of the same political coin?
Not at all. I don't know what the Tea Party's emphasis was other than the fact that they hated President Obama. They hated the fact that we had that the Democratic Party was trying to deal with issues that affected everybody in the country. And the Tea Party was trying to go back to states' rights, themselves was trying to implement policies that would impede the progress and the upward mobility of everyone in the country. This movement that we have, the Forward Together movement that Dr. Barber started and the NAACP started, is to protect the rights that all of us have and to expand those rights and to make America what it's supposed to be in terms of making sure that our constitutional rights are not only protected and implemented, but they are expanded and strengthened to the point that more people can participate in the electoral process, more people can participate in what is called our constitutional right, but that also that we can receive the benefits of our labor, the benefits of our work, and the benefits of those who have gone before us to make it possible for us to sustain in this country.
You know, when the Occupy movement surfaced in response to the Tea Party movement, one of the criticisms that was that they were leaderless, and their mission, their goals were not at all defined, whereas the Tea Party was the exact opposite. What have you learned from both of those movements, or did you learn anything that you applied in your protests?
The most important thing is everything that the NAACP does and the folks that we work with in our HK on J Coalition and the Forward Together movement is that we sit down three or four times a week, look at all of the issues, look at all of the policies, and we determine what is the most germane, what is the most applicable terms and meaning that we can put into what we're doing, what is the most effective strategy that mm-hmm. we could use to embrace the community, to embrace the Constitution, to embrace the laws, to make them work for everybody. So we had an end game, and the most important thing is to get the people involved, make them aware of what's going on, to make sure that more people go out and participate in the electoral process or the political process by registering to vote and voting, but they got to know what they're registering to vote for. Mm-hmm. So we utilize Moral Mondays to somewhat pull the cover off of our elected officials and pull the cover off of these laws so they won't sneak into the community and then nobody knows. We want people to ask questions. We want people to find out what this is all about and how these things affect them.
I believe we have Dr. Barber back with us. Are you there, Doctor?
I am.
Okay. I know that there were many issues other than the voter ID law that the Moral Monday demonstrations or demonstrators wanted to express their opinions on. One is what the legislature has done with regard to funding education. One of the protesters had a sign that said, "I don't want a tax cut. I want good schools." They were also protesting shifting public money to private school vouchers and what they saw as incursions on women's rights. Talk about education. Well, how do you view what's happened with education under the current legislature?
Could I for a second, Mike, go back to one piece and wrap education in? First of all, the Moral Monday movement is not a spontaneous movement. We've been organizing for 7 years, building a new coalition, a new fusion movement in North Carolina called Historic Thousands on Jones Street People's Assembly, which has over 150 parts. We built that movement on a strong anti-racist, anti-poverty, pro-justice, a deeply moral, deeply constitutional a framework. And it worked. We were successful in winning progressive voting laws, winning more for progress in education. What reason we were able to mobilize so fast, Mike, is because we had already done the hard work of bringing people together. And the Moral Monday movement is based on the biblical moral principles of justice and doing right by your neighbor, and the constitutional principles of life, liberty, the enjoyment of your fruit of your own labor, and the pursuit of happiness and equal protection under the law. That's the moral framework. And when you examine this current General Assembly, it doesn't matter if they're Republican. This movement is not liberal versus conservative, not Republican versus Democrat. It's about what's extreme versus what's constitutional, what's immoral versus what's moral. When you cut $1.2 billion from public education and erode public education, deconstruct it, and fire teachers in the South particularly, where public education is needed like never before. That's immoral, and we believe a violation of our deepest constitutional values. When you cut taxes for the wealthy, but then you raise taxes on the working poor and 85% of North Carolinians, we believe that's extreme, that's immoral. When you deny 500,000 people Medicaid, poor people, poor children, and when you cut 170,000 people's unemployment who lost jobs of no fault of their own, that's immoral, that's extreme. When you attack voting rights, that's immoral and that's extreme. And what we're saying is North Carolina needs to move forward by focusing on economic sustainability, jobs, education equality for all, health care for all, dealing with the disparities in the criminal justice system, and protecting and expanding voting rights. This legislature, if by any measure, is extreme and engaging in activities that's immoral. It doesn't mean the individual person is immoral. It's the policy, Mike. It's the policy. And that's why it's not a black movement. Black and white and Latinos and gay and straight and labor and people of faith have all come together and said we can do better than this in this state, and we have to. And the key in the South is people coming together that have usually been divided by the extreme demand sources in order to hold on to power.
I have 20 seconds left. Do you think you've had an impact in Raleigh, and do you think moving these protests around the state, one's coming to Charlotte this afternoon, is going to have a further impact?
I think we've had a tremendous impact.
When we started, the legislature was here in the polls. Now Maul Mundy is higher than them. Less than 1 out of 5 North Carolinians agree with them. The governor's poll numbers have plummeted. And we are different than our crowd and different than the Tea Party. Tea Party wanted to go backwards in the time. We want to go forward.
And Dr. William Barber, you get the last word. President of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, and Kojun Ntambu, president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg chapter.
Thank you, sir.